The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. And so, I was wondering what to talk about today, and it felt to me that I couldn't ignore the events in Japan somehow, and it seemed somehow important to respond in some way. And so I think most of you saw that all that your donations today, IMC won't take any, I won't take any, we'll all put it towards the American Red Cross so that they can, there's not that many kind of large relief agencies that do this kind of work in the world. And American Red Cross is one of them, is capable of going out there and doing something. So make a donation to them and make a teeny difference. There was a book written many years ago, or some years ago, by some scholars of religion, and they were analyzing Christianity in the West, how, what Christian pastors teach, what goes on in churches. And I don't know much about this, I don't know the accuracy of the book or anything, but the concepts were interesting. And they said that there are two approaches to creating a religion or giving religious teachings in America. The most common, by far, is helping people to helping to comfort people. And and what's much more less common is what's challenging people. So they set up this dichotomy between coping and challenging. I mean, comforting and challenging. And so when we come to Buddhism here in the West, I've heard some of the same criticism towards some of us Dharma teachers. Is we give talks that are comforting. I don't use those words exactly, but rather than challenging. And what does it mean to challenge? And do people really want to be challenged? Many years ago, when I was a relatively new Zen student, I went to my Zen teacher and said that if I sat in full lotus, meditated in full lotus, my legs would hurt pretty quickly, but I would get really concentrated. And so, should I sit in full lotus in order to have pain, basically, is what I said. And he said, no, don't go look for pain. Don't go create it. But when it comes, don't turn away from it. And so, and then the other thing I'm thinking about is, this wonderfully symbolic or evocative teaching or myth or story the Buddhists tell themselves, that the Buddha led a very sheltered life, a comfortable life. He was comforted. And then at some point, he left the palace, he left his comfort world to see what was out there. And then he was challenged by what he saw. And in the myth, he was challenged by sickness, seeing a sick person. He was challenged by aging, an old person, and he's challenged by death. And so some of us in the West here at times, and not just the West, but live comfortable lives. And then at some point, something happens that is the end of innocence. Or something happens where we know our belief system, our way we live our life, is no longer comforting for us. We're challenged in some profound way. And then the question is, what do we do when we get challenged? And for some people, the events in Japan, and certainly for the Japanese, are very challenging. But for some people here in the West, it's quite challenging. Quite distressing for people. And what happens? How do we respond when we're challenged, when our worldview is turned upside down, or when we feel that, you know, how connected we are, and events far away have an impact on us here. They have impact on us because many of us saw the images of what happened in Japan. And it's unbelievable to look at these videos of innumerable cars being washed through the countryside as if they're just toys bopping in the water. Houses being lifted up and floating away. Tremendous devastation. And it's challenging to see that happen to human beings, and challenging for, you know, how do we respond, how do we care for these people. And it's also challenging to our sense of comfort and safety. We build up a life that we try to be everything safe and comfortable, and we realize maybe how amazingly vulnerable this human life is. It used to be that our Sunday mornings were conducted on top of the San Andreas Fault. Some of us remember that. And at some point we moved here. as if we were safer. 3 miles away. And we met in what used to be a elementary school in Portola Valley. And when they realized they built a school on top of San Andreas Fault, they said, well, this doesn't work. So they closed it as a school, but then they let us use it. And some of you were here in 1989 when the earthquake struck. Some of you have been down to Santa Cruz Harbor and seen what happened there recently. And so, you know, how safe are our lives is a very interesting question. And how much do we try to put up walls? How much do we try to pretend things are different than what they are? And some of the way we pretend isn't actually active pretending, but, you know, it's ignorance. We try not to look at those things, or we live long enough, we lower our guard and we think, oh, everything is perfect here and safe. But it's not that safe because many of us are struggling anyway. I read a statistic, I think this last couple of days, that something like 1 in every 5 Americans are cancer survivors. I thought that was a pretty high number. I thought, you know, when you get cancer, it's kind of like a rare thing. Turns out it's normal. Kind of, 1 in 5. And we live our lives, and sooner or later, it's the end of innocence. Sooner or later, we meet something, and sometimes we meet something in the world around us. Sometimes we meet something in our family and ourselves. And then how do we respond? The story about the Buddha, you know, leaving the palace and seeing these sights, chances are pretty good that was a myth, but it's a pretty good one, I think. And his response to, in the myth, of seeing these things was he didn't retreat back into the palace people focus on the fact that he became a renunciant. Some people don't like it, you know, how could he do that? But from a different point of view, what he did was rather than going back into the palace, he ventured forth out into the world. And he went out to meet it and to face it and try to come to terms with it and work with it. And this idea of turning towards rather than turning away is a very important principle that I think is inherent in Buddhist practice. You don't go look for trouble, but you don't turn away. And you're willing to face. And I think one of the strengths of Buddhism is not that it's willing to comfort automatically, but rather it gives us the skills, the capacity, the teachings, the practices to help us when we turn towards this life as it actually is, and to deal with it directly and work with it directly. So maybe you'll forgive me by telling you a fairy tale that there was a, and I apologize for these way these their fairy tales are traditionally written. But then this begins with this beautiful young lady. who gets promised in marriage by her parents, promise her in marriage to an ugly, hideous serpent. So this beautiful lady goes to a wise old woman and says, "Look, what am I going to do? I've been promised to marriage this ugly, ugly, ugly serpent of a being." And the wise woman says, "When you go for your wedding, when you dress for your wedding, put on 10 wedding gowns. And then when you come to your wedding bed, when it's time to take off your clothes, tell the serpent that you'll take off each time you take off one of your dresses, he has to take off one of his skins." And so she takes off a dress, and he takes off a skin. And she takes off a dress, and he takes off the skin. And she gets down, the instructions were, when the wise woman was, take off, wear your 10 gowns, 10 dresses, and when you go to the wedding bed, ask him to take off one skin for every dress you take off. And when you finish taking off all your clothes, embrace him. So they do this thing. She takes off a dress and he takes off his skin. And so it goes 10 times. And the 10th time, she's there naked, exposed, vulnerable, whatever. And he's still an ugly, hideous serpent. I know. And then, but the instructions was to embrace him. So she follows the instructions from the wise woman and embraces the serpent. At that point, the serpent turns into, a beautiful, handsome prince. it's a fairy tale. But these fairy tales, point to something. The idea of being willing to expose ourselves, being willing to open up, take off the shields, take off the armor that we have, and then meet our life directly. But not just kind of take it off, but then to embrace. The Buddha went out from the palace and engaged the world to see what was there and face it, to embrace the going towards and face something. And so what would it look like to be comforted by the events, comforted in the context of the events in Japan? Maybe 10,000 or more people killed and huge devastation. And still, people are probably amazingly afraid there, traumatized with what still might come with the nuclear reactors. So what would be comforting for me to sit here and tell you? We'll be comforting. Oh, it's okay, it's far away. You're safe. Would that be good? Or it's their karma. That's not, Or, it's God, God's will. And what we have to do is commit ourselves to God and things will be okay. God knows what's best. I don't know what kind of comforting teachings to give, but I don't think that we should be here and comfort each other in any kind of way, except unless the comforting is a comforting that tells us that it's okay to face this stuff honestly and fully. And so what does it mean? And it's okay to do that. It's appropriate to turn towards and be present and really see. And myself, I think it's very, if you haven't seen the videos, if you're, say, away from such things, I actually think it's important to witness these kinds of things. It's us, it's not them, it's us, it's happening to us, it's our world. It's not so far away. We had an earthquake recently in New Zealand. And it's a little strange story, but only after the earthquake did I find out my father was there. Not so far away, it's close by. I remember reading last September, I think, about floods in Himalayas, in places like Bhutan and different places, and you know, it was pretty bad in some places, only to find out in December that my good friend John Travis was there and witnessed whole villages being swept away because he was uphill from it. It's all not so far away. They were connected in some deep ways. So what does it mean to kind of turn towards these things and efface it? So there's ways of being, you know, so there's all kinds of responses we can have. And a hugely important part of what Buddhism teaches is we turn towards, in a sense, but not necessarily, we don't always turn towards the event, but we turn first and foremost towards how we react to it. What's happening with us? Because if we have a really strong fear or distress or anxiety or upset around this, the question is not that you have upset and fear, but how do we relate to it? What do we do with that? Because if we're not wise about it, that fear and distress can lead to very unfortunate responses with us. We can shut down, we can go numb, we can go search for comforting, romantic teachings that somehow tells us everything's going to be okay. We can get angry. We can give up. There's all kinds of things we can do that are disempowering. And there's ways of responding that are empowering or maybe enlivening or open us up that don't involve anxiety, don't shut us down, but maybe even are liberating and freeing. I myself love the word responsibility, not because it can mean obligation. I don't like obligation one bit. I don't like life, obligated life. But I like the word responsibility because of the meaning of the ability to respond. And so we all have the ability to respond. And we don't have an obligation to respond externally, but I think we have, I don't know if we have any obligation at all, but when the response bubbles up inside of us, our natural ability to respond happens, and we block it, then we suffer. If we block it, we diminish ourselves. If we block it, it's deadening to who we are. If the response that we have is given space, is looked at, and been present, then we find where's the attachment, where's the clinging, what am I holding on to, and learn to release it. And then there's still a response to help. And if we block that response, then we do a violence to ourselves. But if we act on the response in some way or other, then I think, I don't know, it's just, it, I don't know what it is. It's just, then it's, if we act on the desire to help, it's, that just, I don't know, it doesn't have to be anything. It's just the acting to respond. It doesn't have to be for any purpose exactly except to help. What I'm trying to say is that there's a natural response. When the heart is clear and clean, there's a natural desire to respond. And to block that response does a kind of violence. To act on the response, to allow that response to come forth, we're not obligated to do. No one has to do it. But it's there, coming forth. And one of the surprises for me in my encounter in my Buddhist practice was the degree to which the empty mind, the empty heart, is a responsive heart. Response. And what I mean by empty is not, it means empty of attachment, of greed, of hate, empty of self-clinging, empty of identification and being caught, empty of ambition, empty of fear. And to be able to be present and transparent and clear and kind of empty of concerns, empty of the future and the past even in a certain kind of way, in that beautiful emptiness, clarity, emptiness like a the heart wants to respond. Our connectedness, our empathy still operates. And then we'll come forth. Something comes forth out of us. And I think all of us know that because all of us, I hope, all of us have some experience of maybe a neighbor who is in some problem. And of course you'll go help your neighbor. Of course you'll go help your friend or your relative. It just kind of comes easy. You don't think about it so much. It's just, oh, that's what you do. And then when it's something like far away, half a world away like Japan, if it's a small thing, you know, if it had been an earthquake there in Japan and five people had died, you know, it's a significant, but, you know, the heart, when you're far away, the heart doesn't reverberate quite as strong. Not many of us are sending relief money to Crescent City. But they're devastated there. And or to Santa Cruz Harbor. But you know, something happens to the psyche, to the heart, when it's so big, so massive, as what's going on in Japan, that I think there's a movement to respond. And what is that movement? There's a movement to react. What is their reactivity? What's the movement to respond? Which gets the upper hand? Our fear and our distress, or our ability to respond? And what I find beautiful is that I just find beautiful that the heart responds. And I don't know if we need to have any hope. You know, to offer people hope is to offer comfort. I don't know if people need hope. Exactly. It depends how you define hope. And to give hope and comfort. I think it's beautiful and enough just to know that we can respond. Or just to respond, to act. The freed heart will act. And you have to be successful in how you act. You have to succeed. I think it's just that we act. We do. It's enough. So the story that I've told of, a little, you know, analogy. If a fly lands on the back of an ant, it's a big deal for the ant, I think. You know, it's heavy and awkward. But if a fly lands on the back of an elephant, the elephant couldn't care less. Doesn't bother the elephant. The elephant goes forth and does what it wants to do. So the question is, how do you live your life? Do you live your life like an ant? Are you an ant? Or are you an elephant? And I think many people live like ants, where they feel disempowered, they feel like they're victims of things, everything's hard, things are coming and making their life difficult, and we need to be protected and taken care of, and there's a lot of things that just are threatening because we don't feel so empowered, we don't feel so capable of take care of ourselves, and we feel easily threatened. So easily threatened that our comfort, our nice way of living, and my safety is somehow challenged. But what if we live like elephants? What if we live as if we're capable and huge? And I would like to believe that this is what Buddhist practice points to, or trains people to become elephants for the world. And in the ancient suttas, sometimes the Buddha is called the elephant, the great elephant. So probably flies didn't bother him too much. But so to turn towards the world, and then this kind of innate ability to respond, I think, you know, is enough. What if we don't live with fear? What if we, even if you end up being homeless, what's a homeless elephant like? As opposed to a homeless ant? So, what is it like to be somehow feel like you can be your own agent or your own empowered person, your own, that you're efficacious, you can act in the world? And I think that it's supported a lot, this whole ability to be an elephant, when you realize that the most important way of becoming an elephant is to have some mastery of your own reactivity. If you're not going to succumb to your fear, to your anger, succumb to your greed and addiction, and you know you're not going to do that, you're independent and free of those things, then you're ready to be an elephant. But if you live caught in your fear, your anxiety, your hatred and anger and resentment, or your greed and addiction, chances are, the more you have that, the more you become like an ant. So what does it take to become an elephant? What is it, and to step forward into the world so that you're meeting the world doesn't, with the distress difficulties of the world, doesn't discourage you, doesn't interfere with you, but the difficulties of the world is just a reason for you to respond as the world needs, as the situation needs. There's no need for hope, there's no need for discouragement. There's no need to be surprised. How could this be? There's no need to think that, how can I make a difference? There's no need to think it's hopeless. We're all, sooner or later, we're all going to have an earthquake of some kind or other in our life. So I just give up. There's all these reaction responses. If you're an elephant, it's just a beautiful thing to come out, be free, have the freedom, the free kind of emptiness, the freedom where we come forth and we feel like we can respond freely, fully, without the need of teachings that tell you, that comfort you, without teachings that somehow blunt the pain of it all. It's a difficult world, but if the difficulties of the world and of our own life do not encounter our fear, because we freed ourselves of fear, if the difficulties of the world don't encounter our hate, because we freed ourselves of hate, if the difficulties of the world don't encounter our greed and our attachments, because we freed ourselves of it, then the world is not a problem. But it is something we respond to. And as I've said now already, I think that to me it's quite beautiful that the empty heart, the free heart, will respond. But how it responds depends on each individual person, each individual heart. We have so many, each heart has different conditioning, background, ways of being. And so, for example, in my case, you know, I'm regularly quite moved by what I see around the world, what goes on, and I want to respond, but I can't, you know, like you can't respond to it all, no way. But I don't let that... but what I do is I feel the energy inside of me, the impulse to try to respond, to go and do something. And since I can't go to Africa and do something in every place in the world, one of the ways that I respond is I try to do what I do better. I feel like I'm in a kind of helping profession, right? Whatever. And so I said, well, I'm going to try to do it in this corner of the world better. I take that energy and say, okay, I'm more motivated. This is really important. Let's try to do it here really well. And best I can, at least. And so maybe some of you, you know, this thing happens in Japan, and maybe you're not going to send money to Japan or care package to Japan or something. Perhaps you're a school teacher. And so you say, well, I'm really much more motivated. I'm going to go into the classroom tomorrow and just try harder to create a compassionate environment for these kids, because that makes a difference. So how, you know, what is your way to respond? This doesn't have to be directly to the situation. And then there's no obligation. This is, I think that's beautiful, I think, about the freedom. A free heart has no obligation. Obligation is just more attachment. But there is response. So it doesn't mean that because there's no obligation that we're going to be kind of like, you know, Buddhist couch potatoes. What do you mean there's no obligation? Thou shalt, you have to go out, you know, everyone has to do their part and you have to go do. And when you hear those kinds of teachings, probably you should just yawn. Or probably you hear those teachings and you should just leave those teachings in the dust as you go out and do something. There's no obligation, but there is the response. So that's my hope, is that Buddhist practice frees us of the obstacles to being responsive. And then as we become responsive, that we allow that response to move through us freely as action in the world, in small ways, in big ways, whatever way is appropriate for us. And so I thought that as a community today, that we could use our gathering as a time for making a donation to the American Red Cross. And through that vehicle, you know, respond to the world, respond to the situation. And we'll see what further response comes out of us, given the situation. And it's kind of a coincidence that we were supposed to have, after this Dharma talk, a special little a kind of launching party for the Insight World Aid. Some of us here have made a non-profit that is going to be kind of a Buddhist vehicle for offering aid, medical aid primarily, but med aid to different little communities abroad which are in distress or challenged. And the idea was to go, and when we get organized, to Cambodia and do a medical mission in Cambodia. But one of the main people who's been organizing this and created the nonprofit, it turned out he couldn't come today, so we had to postpone it. So I apologize if some of you came for that. But he was postponed it because he had to go to work. And he works as an emergency room physician. So I thought that was kind of poignant. And so we'll do that in June. But it's also kind of poignant that here we have this international catastrophe. And in our small way, we were trying here at IMC to also create something that when the heart wants to respond, that there's a vehicle, a form for it to respond in a beautiful way. So this Inside World Aid is coming, I hope. So those are my thoughts. I hope that they were not too comforting and appropriately challenging. And I hope that it gave a certain kind of context or understanding or background for what this whole Buddhism thing is about. I think, you know, Buddhism, you know, was designed to help us with these kinds of issues, whether it's, you know, issues of life and death, not to sit there and simply enjoy our food better, you know. Be mindful and enjoy the taste of the orange. And be mindful and taste the orange. If you do it really well, then you'll taste the suffering in Japan too. So do you have any comments or things you want to say given all this before we end? Give you a chance. From behind you.
In a discussion yesterday, it's actually in a 12-step program, a friend raised the rhetorical question between being challenged and being defeated. Is that
So what was the question?
You raised the question in terms of his personal practice of the difference emerging for him of being the difference between being challenged and being defeated.
Oh, interesting. I would suspect that that if a person is attached to being comforted, then they're much more likely to be defeated. That comfort and defeat, comfort and discouragement, go hand in hand. Hope and defeat go hand in hand. And so, we're in a certain kind of way. I mean, there's a lot of hope in Buddhism for sure. I mean, you can make a difference. Buddhism says you can make a difference, so that's hopeful, right? So, but Buddhism generally also says, hope's overrated. If you operate on hope too much, it's a setup for more suffering. So there's an alternative to hope that's even more hopeful.
So maybe this is just a semantic difference.
Hold it closer.
I said maybe this is just a semantic difference. But when one despairs, that's very self-defeating. And so there's a sense that you try to provide yourself with hope in order to overcome. So that you try to overcome the difficulties and the despair. So I'm calling it hope. And what's the alternative word or state of mind for that?
I don't know what the alternative is, but what mindfulness practice can teach a person is that when there's something like despair, there's a way of not searching for hope or searching for holding on to hope or an alternative, but rather to turn towards the despair and take off your wedding dress. There's something very powerful. Mindfulness training, where we train to turn towards and be present for things, it's a training, and it takes some understanding of how to do it in a wise way. We're not despairing, not being mindful so we can despair better, but rather we're mindful so we can go in there and allow the innate natural freedom that, or the processing or the opening that can happen when we really meet and are present for it. If we skirt around the edges, if we avoid, if we're searching for something outside of us, it might be helpful over time, but there's something very powerful and freeing about turning towards and really feeling something fully without, when you feel it fully, without succumbing to our fears or our angers or self-attachments that we might have. So it's a whole training. And if you learn that training of mindfulness, then we can learn to move into whatever. And then there's no need for hope. Does that make some sense? So?
Maybe the word you're looking for is perseverance.
So here.
Yeah. This was a wonderful talk, very timely. And I just happened to see a movie that on exactly this topic on Friday night called Of Gods and Men. And the Dharma friends are going to go see it next Sunday afternoon, so there's flyers out there. But it's about 8 monks who are faced with what's going to inform how they live their lives, the fear and the hatred and the violence of their environment or their deep love for their community.
So they decide to be ants or elephants in the end?
Well, you see them go through a lot of struggle. I mean, it wasn't sort of like an intellectual decision. Am I going to be an ant or am I going to be an elephant? But it really took feeling fully what being an ant is like, to be able to move to being an elephant, both as individuals and as a community.
Beautiful. That's great. So those of you who are ants, don't despair. The beautiful thing about mindfulness is it's okay to be an ant if you turn towards antness and really know what being an ant is really like, and you'll find that when the ant takes off her dress, there's an elephant there. So one more, and then.
So as you're talking about hope or not having hope, I also kind of, some words came to mind, which is kind of confidence and courage.
Mm.
And I was wondering, what do you think the relationship is, you know, to kind of not having hope with this, you know, maybe these ideas in Buddhism, which are said to be really important as well?
Yeah, we don't want to push this no hope thing too much, because I mean, Buddhism offers a lot of hope. It's just that the attachment to hope, or, you know, there's the wrong kind of hope. But I like the word confidence and courage a lot. And I think sometimes it takes tremendous courage and confidence to face what's going on, whether it's out in the world or in ourselves. I don't want to underestimate the tremendous difficulties that people are living under, and difficulties in their own psychological difficulties, their fear, their anxiety. And I mean, those are really profound issues that, and so, but sometimes in order to face it and live with it or act in the world in spite of it, takes a lot of courage, a lot of confidence. So I'll end with a little thing that the Buddhist word for confidence is sada, the Sanskrit word sada. And many years ago I read that a scholarly study of the origins of that word in India back in the Vedic times. And the claim was the original meaning of the word sada, ashrada in Sanskrit, is hospitality. And so so when that ugly, hideous serpent comes, maybe to have confidence, to have courage, is also to have a certain kind of hospitality. Like, here, come. Come, I'll take off a dress if you take off your skin. So thank you, and we have this tea now, and there's some, I think, some snacks and stuff people put out. And if there might be some new people here today, if you are new, I believe this is a relatively friendly community, so don't be shy, you know, to walk up to someone and say hello. Or, and to those of you who've been here a while, if you notice someone around who is, you don't notice, you notice someone around who, you know, you don't recognize, you know, please say hello and make everyone feel welcome. Thank you.